Hello, this is a free call from an offender at Clemens Unit. This call is being recorded and is subject to monitoring. To accept this free call, press 1. To refuse this free call, press 2. Thank you for using CenturyLink. You may start the conversation now.
I was arrested on my mom's birthday, so it's a date that I'll never be forgotten.
You know, I heard the announcement of the war on drugs, you know, when Nixon, when he came out and made that declaration, and then I come back and I see the results of it, the casualties just so widespread and so lasting that, you know, it's just destruction. Then you see the prison that's just packed up.
4 attempted murders, an assault 1, and 4 counts of unlawful use of a weapon. Was it 17 years? 8 months.
99 years for theft.
It's easier for you to take out your anger on somebody that's on equal footing with you than somebody that's up higher than you, because those, you know, have major consequences.
That penitentiary love, you know, that, oh yeah, you know, we can go up there to the county and give them that window love, and I'm just like, okay, like, because it's not funny. But I also get, too, that you joke and you have to do things like that. So that way, that's just another way of telling yourself it's okay. He's caught his chains. He's gone.
God, they're trying to break me. That's not going to happen.
Hey, Nicole.
Hey, Sean.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm full of wonder and joy.
Great.
You have a new podcast coming out, don't you?
This is it.
Oh, what is it?
It's called Prison Breakdown.
Prison Breakdown. I can imagine what this is about. I'm sensing multiple meanings here. Breakdown. We're going to take a very heavy subject and we're going to simplify it.
We're going to break it down.
Break it down. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but there's also an intention behind the podcast, too.
What's your intention?
To break it down.
Ah, that keeps coming up.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's also Prison Break.
Ah.
Right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Sounds awesome. So tell us more about the podcast.
Well, this is the opening episode.
Ooh, the pilot episode.
That's right. This is the pilot. And today I'm going to be interviewed by my really good friend, Ju Young.
So your friend, Ju Young, is going to interview you about your work in prison activism.
That's right. She's going to ask me about my background, how I became interested in this in the first place, why I'm passionate about it, and also why I'm hopeful about the possibilities for change in the current moment.
That's great material for a pilot episode.
Don't you think? Because people need to know, you know, who I am and what I'm about, right?
Exactly, yeah. You need to introduce yourself.
Yeah. And then we're going to take a break, and then when we come back from the break, we're going to introduce the subject matter. So that's when we're going to talk about, you know, what are the defining features of mass incarceration? What are some of the common misperceptions that people have about it? And also, how does the criminal justice system work? Because there is a lot of confusion about it, because it is very complicated.
Yeah, it is definitely a very complicated subject. I do know that the United States has more people incarcerated than any other country, and this is supposed to be the land of the free.
You know, that's true. So that is one of the defining features of mass incarceration. So let's not get ahead of ourselves yet, Sean.
Okay.
But I'm glad you know that. I am glad you know that. Yeah. All right. So let's get started.
All right. Let's go.
It sounds like a real thing. I love it. Well, what do I want to say about myself? I did not know much about mass incarceration until I met Nicole, and I learned so much from her, and it really inspired me to do something about it. And it's an honor to interview her and ask her some questions.
Thanks.
Yeah. So let's start with your background and why you are making this podcast.
Well, let's see. So I first entered a prison in 1998 when I was a sophomore in college at UC Berkeley. And I had a professor who, as a volunteer, was teaching a communications class at San Quentin Prison. And he was inviting students from his classes at UC Berkeley to work as tutors in the prison, helping students for this very fledgling college program that had just gotten started at San Quentin and was run entirely by volunteer professors from the Bay Area. So I went into San Quentin for the first time, and, you know, I come from a middle-class background. I don't have family members who are incarcerated. I was aware of prisons and of racial justice issues because I grew up in San Francisco, and I'm an urban youth, and I listen to hip-hop, so I had been hearing about it, but I didn't have any personal familiarity. And so going to the prison was really my first exposure, and I just had a really compelling and profound experience in meeting people who had been incarcerated for decades, mm-hmm. in some cases, who were incredibly kind and respectful and grateful to have people coming in from the outside, and just really, it kind of exploded any mainstream perception that I might have had about people in prison.
Wow. Yeah, I would have been surprised myself.
Yeah, I think for many people, you know, unless you are really impacted directly by these issues and you have family members that have been inside, we really our view of prison is shaped by the kind of local news, mm-hmm. Or by, you know, movies and videos, yeah. and stuff. And it's these portrayals of prisoners as sociopaths, and it's like your world turns upside down,
yeah.
when you go inside and actually come face to face with a human being, mm-hmm. who is living this experience. And I ended up tutoring for that college program for that whole year. And then I took a break. But when I graduated from college, it was on my mind, like, that this was a really meaningful experience and that I wanted to continue, mm-hmm. doing it. So I got back in touch with that program and started volunteering again. And then that ultimately turned into a job. So I worked for 4 years from 2002 to 2006, helping to coordinate this 2-year community college program that operated inside San Quentin and provided like a 2-year associate of arts degree to incarcerated men at the prison. And it was really like that experience is what I continue to feel inspired by and to be motivated by and to draw from in all of the work that I've done since then.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2006, I had kind of, you know, I felt like I had learned what I could learn from that experience and was really feeling like I wanted to work on more structural changes and policy level changes to the system because, you know, we were having this really meaningful impact on individual people's lives. And mm-hmm. also, I would say, on the culture of life inside San Quentin. But it was so frustrating to feel like, you know, you could be working with more and more individuals and having this effect on the personal level, but there was just this flood of people who just kept coming in and kept having these, you know, excessively long sentences and living in these horrible conditions, and like we weren't making a dent into mm-hmm. any of that. So I was really interested in working more on sentencing policy or just at the broader policy level to see if there was a way to actually affect some kind of change in the system itself. And so I ended up moving to New York, and I worked for 2 years at the Prisoner Reentry Institute at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And I worked on reentry issues, which is the experience of people coming out of prison and making a life for themselves on the outside. And I looked at higher education as a pathway to successful reentry and also entrepreneurship, because mm-hmm. people face so many barriers to getting hired in regular jobs. Yeah. So we were looking at that. And then I just decided that it was time for me to go back to school.
Mm-hmm.
And that was mainly because I just felt like I didn't really have a grasp on the system itself, and that even working on the policy level, you know, I was often in positions of, you know, giving a presentation and saying these are the best practices or this is something that people should be doing. But I felt a little bit like a phony in the sense that it's like it's a very vast and complex phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I really felt like in order to be able to speak authentically and powerfully in my own voice about these issues, that I needed to understand it at a deeper level.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I went to graduate school, and I spent 8 years in graduate
wow.
school.
I remember the later years of your time.
Yes.
It was difficult.
Yes. It was climbing a mountain. But I do feel like I came out of it knowing what I need to know.
Great.
Yeah, I really do.
So I want to go back a little bit to those very initial years,
sure,
beginning of those experience. What happened when you went to the prison? Sounds like it really impacted you. And
yeah.
I don't think I've ever asked you, you know, when we hung out, like what happened when
yeah.
you went in?
Wow. It's like so many things happened and I'm still unpacking it, and I feel like it'll be a lifetime. You know, one of the things that has been coming up for me lately is remembering in those times, that period specifically, 2002 to 2006, probably about half the student body of the college program at San Quentin is people who are serving life sentences.
Mm-hmm.
So they're serving life with the possibility of parole, which means that they are serving 10 to life or 20 to life or 25 to life. And when they get to about 85% of that minimum set of years, so let's say they're serving 20 to life, so once they get to about serving 18 years, they are able to go in front of a parole board, which determines whether they're eligible for mm-hmm. parole. In those years, nobody with a life sentence was being found suitable for parole. And in the very, very small percentage of cases, like the less than 1% of cases
mm-hmm.
in which the parole board found somebody suitable, the governor of the state of California was vetoing the parole, which is a unique power that the governor has in California specifically. And this was because this was still in the height of what we call the tough on crime era,
mm-hmm.
the era when all of the rhetoric about people in prison and criminals was about locking them up and throwing away the key. It was purely about punishment. All of these, both Democratic and Republican politicians, were running campaigns on being tough on criminals and
mm-hmm.
tough on crime. And it worked. It just was working.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they would get into office and they would pass another law to make good on their campaign promise that made sure that people were staying in prison for even longer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the governor at that time of California, a man named Gray Davis, had made an explicit comment to the press that no lifer would be leaving prison under his watch except in a pine box. That was the
wow.
quote. Like,
yeah.
So except in a coffin. So that's the only way people were going to be getting out.
So you walked into a very intense situation.
Very hopeless
yes.
situation.
Yes.
Very hopeless. And this is also to say, like, part of why this really was meaningful for me is because probably at least half of our student body was composed of lifers. And the lifers were actually like our colleagues in the sense that they were the ones maintaining stability among the student body and the broader prison population.
Mm-hmm.
They were the leaders in there. They were the mentors, the people who were recruiting younger prisoners, people who were serving shorter sentences to come and participate. They were mediating disputes. They were policing the classrooms in ways that we didn't even realize at the time.
That's amazing.
Yes. So these are people that over the course of this 4 years, I developed really strong relationships with. Mm. And we shared this really deep sense of urgency around the importance of this program, the importance of this opportunity for people. So, you know, I was really deeply bonded with all of these men who were never going to get out of prison.
And they are still there.
Well,
okay.
the winds of change are upon us.
Yeah.
So actually, starting in around 2010, the political winds shifted, mm-hmm. and now people are getting out.
Wow.
So many of these people are out, and I actually interviewed many of them for my dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
So there is hope now, and that's one of the things that, you know, is really motivating to me in this moment, is that I actually have a lot of hope about mass incarceration being in decline and being in a phase of disintegration, mm-hmm. as opposed to a phase of building, which it was for my whole life. It's been in a building phase. And only in the past 5 years or so, 5 to maybe 8 years, have the conversation started to shift around it, has awareness started to grow, and has political pressure started to move in a direction that's more open to reform and reducing the population and that kind of thing. But that moment of being inside was really impactful in the sense that I was both developing extremely meaningful relationships with people who were locked up,
mm-hmm.
who in many cases were inspirations to me and provided me with wisdom and kindness and generosity and leadership and, you know, like really meaningful people who I really cherish, combined with this very bleak, dehumanizing, unjust, hopeless set of conditions that just felt completely insurmountable. You know, like I'm never going to see these people on the outside. They're never going to reconnect with their family. They're never going to be found suitable, even though they are providing really meaningful leadership and are working with very high levels of integrity in
Amazing.
This environment.
Yeah. Are you still talking to some of these people?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm friends with many of them on Facebook. Seriously. I actually just the other day, it was my birthday a month or two ago, and I got a beautiful message from one of these people on Facebook, kind of honoring me for my birthday, that was really, really touching. And he's someone that served 40 years in prison and was considered the mayor of San Quentin when I was inside, because he was the chairman of the Men's Advisory Council,
mm-hmm.
which is the organization that represents incarcerated men and kind of helps resolve disputes and interact with staff around potential issues and prisoners' rights and stuff.
So you've known these people over 20 years?
Some of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, more like 15 or so, but Yeah, I was in L.A. Last week, and I had dinner with somebody that I met in 2002 who graduated from the college program, got out in 2007, and now runs a successful restaurant chain in L.A. And he treated me to dinner, and we caught up and talked about mass incarceration. And it's really – and he actually – you know, I did a fundraising campaign earlier in this year to get me to this kind of social justice conference in Greece. Mm-hmm. He sent me a check for $500 for my campaign. Yeah.
So there are people doing really well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
people
wonderful.
Are. There's many people who are getting out who are successful and who are really contributing in meaningful ways to their communities. Like this guy. So now he runs a restaurant chain. He employs over 70 people in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
But for the first several years after he got out, he worked for a nonprofit organization in San Francisco addressing tensions between Asian and Black communities in mm-hmm. San Francisco. So creating youth programs, some, you know, having grown up in San Francisco myself, the tensions between the Asian and the Black community can mm-hmm. run really high.
Does he have Asian or Black
background? Yeah, he's Vietnamese.
Oh, okay. That's really awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So I think we were talking about you getting into PhD program, finishing it. A very difficult time, but you got out with this new purpose.
Yes.
What's going on?
So in going to grad school, you are being trained to become a college professor.
Mm-hmm.
And towards the end of grad school, when I was writing my dissertation, it started becoming more and more clear to me that I was not totally interested in pursuing that path of becoming a professor. Not because I have anything against it. I think it's a super valuable profession, of course, and I've had amazing experiences in my own education.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we're in a special moment when it comes to mass incarceration because, like I was saying, for the first time since the 70s, there's actually a conversation happening about the inhumanity of the system and the injustices of the system and its size and its racial concentration and its, you know, and its connection to slavery and how much money we're spending on it. And mm-hmm. all of these things are starting to become kind of household conversations. So all of a sudden, it's like there's this possibility for change,
yeah.
you know, and not to mention the Black Lives Matter movement, right, which is bringing attention largely to police brutality, but police brutality, police contact is the first point of contact with the criminal justice system. So it's literally the tip of the iceberg, you know, where people begin with their mm-hmm. contact and then they go to jail and then they go through the court system and then they're sentenced and then they're charged and mm-hmm. then they go to prison, right? So it's absolutely integrally connected to mass incarceration. So there's all of this opportunity right now to shape the changes that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it just feels like I want to be taking what I know and educating people, but I want to be educating the general public. And I want to be doing community organizing and movement building around this issue because I really agree with Michelle Alexander and many other people. Michelle Alexander is the author of The New Jim Crow.
Oh, yeah.
That in order to address mass incarceration, we have to have a social movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a vast and complex phenomenon that there needs to be a whole groundswell of people getting involved, getting educated, and taking action on this issue in order to push it in a progressive direction and to make sure that whatever reforms happen aren't just tinkering,
mm-hmm.
you know, that they're actually meaningful and substantive because there's this real potential right now to dramatically rethink the way that we think about punishment and accountability and crime and violence. And so nobody knows exactly where this is going to go and what the next thing to emerge is going to be. But I really think it's an all hands on deck moment in terms of pushing it to be as transformative as we can possibly make it.
Mm-hmm.
And pushing it, you know, taking advantage of this opportunity to talk about the root issues that underlie mass incarceration, like racial justice and white supremacy.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like slavery is just going to evolve into some new form beyond mass incarceration unless we really start confronting mm-hmm. the history of white supremacy and racism in this country against people of color generally, but specifically against Black Americans.
Yep.
You know, we have to talk about the war on drugs because, you know, first of all, drug criminalization has always been tied to fear around an ethnic or racial minority. And the war on drugs as we know it today, meaning its escalation in the 80s, was the primary driver behind the sentencing policy that has resulted in these exploding prison populations. Mm-hmm. So I also think it's a really ripe moment to start thinking about drug decriminalization, if not legalization, and the transfer of the regulation of drugs to a medical and public health model from the criminal justice system. And mm-hmm. so, you know, but if we don't get involved, that kind of more visionary thinking, it's not going to happen on its own, mm-hmm. right? No politician is going to take the risk to do that without there being a cover from a public that's mobilized and that says this is what we want. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested in educating people, helping them to organize themselves so that we are contributing to this larger movement around these issues. And I guess the final piece of that I'll say, because this is really tied into kind of my agenda personally, is that the people that I'm most interested in supporting in all of this and getting involved and mobilizing and thinking about solutions and going to state capitals and talking to legislators and talking to public officials are the people who have been directly impacted by incarceration themselves. So meaning people who are formerly incarcerated, people who are currently incarcerated, and their families and neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So they're the people who know the law better than anybody else. They're the people who understand the conditions that led to their incarceration in the first place. You know, so one of my passions is around supporting people who have had this experience and who have come through it, who have reflected on their lives and who are mobilized, you know, and personally mm-hmm. excited to get involved on this issue, supporting them to connect with each other and network and start building a movement where they're at the front and center. And those of us that have been less impacted by the issue are supporting them, getting involved, but not speaking for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Now I have a different understanding of you as a person and why you have a hard time falling asleep sometimes.
Mm.
It's a very exciting moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is. Ju-young is referencing my insomnia lately, just lately. It's a new issue for me.
Yeah.
Okay, let's
go into
thank you.
What is mass incarceration?
Okay, great. So I think of mass incarceration as having three defining features. And this is like where it's time to start taking notes.
Okay. For the listeners.
For the listeners. Class has begun. Three main features of mass incarceration. Okay, number one, starting in 1973, after 50 years of stability, incarceration rates started to rise across the U.S., and they continued rising sharply and consistently until about 2010, 2012. So we had nearly four decades of a sharp and consistent rise in incarceration rates that started in 1973. And that's true in terms of the raw numbers of people going to prison, and it's also true in terms of incarceration rates. So when you look at the number of people incarcerated per capita from the 1920s, which is when we began collecting statistics on the prison population, through 1973, the U.S. incarceration rate hovered between 100 and 200 per 100,000. And if you look across the world today, almost all developed countries and many developing countries are still within that range or less or maybe a little bit higher. But that, say, 120 or 150 per 100,000 people are in mm-hmm. prison.
Okay.
Okay. We had that same rate in the U.S. until 1973. That rate increased sharply to the point that we now have over 700 per 100,000 people incarcerated in the U.S. And we are the world leader in incarceration. So we incarcerate more people per capita than any other country in the world. Of the total prison population in the world, the U.S. accounts for 25% of it.
That is so many.
Yes.
People.
Yes.
Absurd.
Yeah. So like there's something really wrong,
yeah.
right? Like that's really all you need to know that there's something wrong is to understand the scale of our incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
Final piece is the fact that incarceration rates are acutely and disproportionately concentrated among communities of color,
mm-hmm.
specifically among Black communities. And so I'm just going to go over a few basic statistics right now just to make this point. These are U.S. incarceration rates by race and ethnicity in the year 2010. And these statistics were compiled by the Prison Policy Initiative. So nationally, in 2010, 380 per 100,000 whites were in prison.
Okay.
966 Latinos were incarcerated per 100,000 Latinos.
So three times more.
Yeah, more than double.
Yeah.
More than double. Among Blacks, 2,207 per 100,000 were
That's
incarcerated.
Way more.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, you know, and something that this particular graph from the Prison Policy Institute doesn't include is the concentration among Native Americans, which
mm-hmm.
is the second highest. And from what I've seen, it's around 1,200 per 100,000. It's higher than the Latino population, but it still is dwarfed by the concentration among Black Americans.
Yeah.
And when you start looking at this at the neighborhood level,
mm-hmm.
you start to see even higher, much higher concentrations, because it's not only about race, it's also about class. So to review, those are the three points that are really critical. So it's the just the raw numbers, the incarceration rates rising across the U.S. over 40 years, the fact that the U.S. now leads the world in incarceration rates, and the acute concentration of incarceration rates among communities of color.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What are the most common misperceptions about mass incarceration among concerned citizens?
You know, there is this growing awareness about mass incarceration, and a lot of progressive people and even actually many people in conservative circles are starting to be concerned about it. And with this growing concern and awareness, there are some ideas that have started to circulate that I think need a little bit of correction. So the first major one, and I have this conversation with people all the time, is it's the private prisons. When I say mass incarceration, they're like, oh, private prisons, right? That's
yeah,
the first
yeah.
thing that comes to people's mind. And I think Orange is the New Black, maybe why.
That's a misperception one.
So it's a misperception in the sense that, yes, private prison, the growth of private prisons is a phenomenon that is connected to mass incarceration. It
mm-hmm.
has emerged during this period of time, but it's not driving incarceration rates and it's not driving mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
So private prison companies like Corrections Corporation of America and GEO Group, they make their bread and butter in immigration detention. So they incarcerate about 62%
mm-hmm.
of people who are detained and incarcerated in immigration detention centers. When you look at the state and federal prison population, they account for about 8% of the total population.
Mm-hmm.
So there is absolutely cause for concern about the existence of private prison companies, because they make a profit off of incarcerating people. And
yeah.
so they therefore have a stake in incarcerating people. when a state government contracts with a private prison company, often the contracts stipulate that they have to remain filled at 92% of capacity. So if a state were to transfer the majority of its prison population to the management of private prison companies, absolutely, that would be a horrifying prospect, because they would be essentially guaranteeing legally that they would keep those prisons filled to 92%.
Yeah.
So for all of those reasons, it's absolutely a concern, and an important concern, that private prison companies exist. And we need to keep tabs on them, because if immigration detention numbers rise, right, under our new federal administration, right, as they continue to grow and make profit, they will be able to lobby state governments more aggressively to create contracts with them.
I see.
Right? So we need to be keeping tabs on them.
Mm-hmm.
The misperception is that private prison companies that are seeking profit is what is driving the rise in incarceration rates.
See. That's clear.
So the point is that we could ban private prison companies.
Mm-hmm.
We could make it illegal for them to exist, and the U.S. would still incarcerate more people per capita than any country in the world by a lot.
Gotcha.
Right? And this has been a state government project, largely, and a federal government project, and a county-level project. But the point is, this is the government. These are elected officials. These are ballot measures, the voting public, who has been creating sentencing policy that brings in more and more people and keeps them in prison for longer and longer periods of time. And while private interests absolutely have a stake in maintaining this system, they developed their stake in maintaining it as these governmental policies started to take effect.
I see. So right? It gives an idea of which battle to pick.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Like, don't get overly distracted.
Yeah.
By private prisons.
Okay, what's the next point? Misperception.
So another misperception is that everyone in prison is there for a nonviolent crime. It's not that people would necessarily claim that, but it's that people are very concerned about those who are serving time for nonviolent, non-serious offenses, and aren't clear on the fact that the majority of people who are doing time in state prisons are there for violent and serious offenses. So, so on the one hand, there's a certain naivete that can be related to this, of people being like, you know, people on the left criticizing the system and being up in arms and all of this stuff, because it's like everyone in prison is there for drug related stuff and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, no, actually, there are many people who are in prison for non-serious, non-violent offenses, and the injustices that many of them are facing in the sentences they're serving and the conditions they're in are egregious. And it's super important, again, to kind of make sure we're focusing on that.
Yeah.
But if we want to really talk in a educated and serious way about prison reform, we can't let the conversation end at what is sometimes referred to as the non-non-nons, the non-serious, non-violent, non-sexual convictions. We have to start grappling with the fact that many people go to prison for the commission of a violent offense.
Yeah, I guess it's easier to take it in when we want to help people, support people who were non-non-non.
Yes, absolutely. It's more politically palatable.
Yeah.
And, you know, Obama did start to really make some moves towards reform at the federal level. But the conversation under Obama ended at the non-non-nons.
Okay.
And so this work, it's not easy work. Mm-hmm. It's not easy unless we start to grapple more deeply with the conditions that lead people to commit violence, and also the potential for redemption and transformation in human beings. we're not going to really make use of this moment to evolve. Like, you know, and that's part of why I think that this issue is so important and I'm so passionate about it, is because it holds the potential in it for us to really learn and evolve, like, our human consciousness. Because those lifers that I was talking about who were serving time at San Quentin and had no hope of getting out, but were also the mentors and the leaders and the colleagues that were making it possible for us to work in there, they were there for violent crimes. I mean, wow. Generally yeah. speaking, that's why you get a life sentence, is because you're convicted of a serious crime. Some of them were there for murder. Some of them were there for murder one. Some were murder two. You know, most of the people that I was the closest with, that I trusted the most, that I felt had the most emotional maturity, were people who had been convicted of violent crimes.
Wow.
So that is this truth of my personal experience that seems very counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is that when somebody has committed violence and they have grappled with the violence that they committed and really reflected in a genuine way about what it was that led them to do it, about their own accountability and the choices they made mm-hmm. in that moment, and also about kind of the personal, psychological, family dysfunctions that may have contributed as well to all of that. And then they've come out on the other side.
Yeah.
They are an asset because they have grappled with their own capacity to do harm in a way that most people have not. And they hold themselves to a really high standard, like where, again, some of the kind of lefties, and I would put myself in this category in working with them, there's times when I have wanted to dismiss the level of harm that they caused.
Wow.
You know, because I felt so connected to them in that moment.
Yeah.
And they don't let you do that.
Yeah. And you're really challenging me to be open toward people who might have murdered somebody.
Yes. Yes. Because the wisdom that a person can carry, it's not like it necessarily happens.
Yeah.
But if someone has really engaged in a genuine process of healing and reflection and accountability, they are an incredible holder of wisdom.
I am intrigued. Okay, let's go to the criminal justice system being complicated. What are the basics that someone needs to know in order to start making sense of it?
Okay, so this is like the criminal justice 101 part of the episode. So already I've been mentioning the state and the federal systems, and maybe we've talked about the county level versus the state level, and you know, the first most important thing for people to understand about the criminal justice quote unquote system is that it's actually like thousands of different systems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's there is no one criminal justice system. It's composed of city and county level law enforcement agencies. Each state has its own prison system. The federal government has its own prison system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the first thing to understand. And within that, people often get jails confused with prisons, or they
yeah.
use those terms interchangeably.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another piece. So when we're talking about a jail, jails operate at the county and sometimes the city level. And they're places that hold people for short periods of time, usually before they've been sentenced, and sometimes after they've been sentenced if they received a misdemeanor conviction, meaning a very low-level conviction that doesn't amount to a felony.
Okay.
So if we're thinking about the kind of linear version of the criminal justice system that begins with contact with the police, mm-hmm. right? So arrest. The police then take somebody to a jail. Jails operate at the county level. They're run by sheriff's offices, and they hold people until they post bail,
mm-hmm.
or if they don't post bail, while they are being processed through the court system. So going to different hearings, being appointed or, you know, getting a lawyer and working through what the charges are going to be and whether they're going to plead guilty or not and doing plea bargaining and all of that kind of stuff
mm-hmm.
through trial, if they do go to trial, and sentencing.
I see.
So that's all happens within the county jail system. And then if they're charged and convicted of these very low level offenses, like, you know, disorderly conduct or something like that, anything that requires less than a year sentence, they would probably serve that sentence within the jail as well. They would never be taken to prison.
Mm-hmm.
So jails end up being very chaotic places because they have this very high level of turnover. People are kind of constantly in and out, and people don't have access to services inside the jail because, like, for example, the college program that I worked at San Quentin, it's hard to have a college program in a jail because very few people are there for long enough to even be able to take a whole class.
It's like a parking lot.
Yes. Cycling in and out.
Rather than long-term parking space.
Yes. So then just to finish that part, a prison is run by the state government, and it's where people go when they're serving, when they've been sentenced and they're serving more than a year. You know, the other piece along that progression that I wanted to talk about was just the plea bargaining, because that is something that happens while people would be in jail waiting for their case to be processed. And the important piece there, this is also a misconception. It's like, you know, in the U.S., we have this whole history of the trial, you know, 12 angry men and To Kill a Mockingbird, like these trial dramas. The fact of the matter is that 97% of criminal cases are pled out. That's how they're decided. They don't mm-hmm. They don't go to trial. The prosecutor tells the public defender, these are the charges that we're going to bring. There may be numerous kind of mandatory sentences in the current age that are attached to those charges.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the defense attorney can make a counteroffer. You know, they basically bargain it out. They mm-hmm. negotiate it. And then the defendant accepts the terms of that, pleads guilty, and that's what their sentence is. So they don't go to trial and they're not judged by a jury or anything like that.
Only 3%.
Only 3% go to trial. Yeah. So 97% are determined through a plea bargaining process. And that's something we'll also talk about in later episodes, is the leverage that the mandatory minimum sentencing policies gave to prosecutors. Because if a charge carries a mandatory 25 to life sentence or a mandatory 10 year to life sentence, then they can offer 22 years and it's a better deal than 25 years.
Yeah.
So I actually know somebody who he had an assault charge from when he was like 18 or 19 and got into a bar fight. Did a little bit of time, got out, but it's on his record. This was like 10 or 12 years later. He had a successful fishing business and he was caught with an unregistered hunting rifle and a personal size bag of methamphetamine. And those were counted as two separate felonies. So two separate strikes
mm-hmm.
with the assault charge as the first strike. And in California, there's a mandatory 25 to life sentence for your third strike. So he was facing 25 years to life for having an unregistered hunting rifle and some meth. And he pled out to a 20-year sentence.
Wow. That's so a long time.
Yes. So he had been serving. Punishment. He had been in prison for 18 years when I met him. Yeah.
Wow.
So that's just one example of how that leverage works in the plea bargaining process.
Okay. Well, that's helpful, and we are going to cover more of that later.
Yes.
We only have a few more minutes left, and
sure.
I want to ask you, what What do you hope people will get from listening to your podcast?
What I hope that they're going to get from this is, first of all, a sense of urgency and outrage about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
This issue has been hiding in plain sight for a long time. And there's now this kind of opening where people's ears are perking up and they're starting to kind of know a little bit more about it. And what I have found is that the more you get to know about this issue, the more outrageous and truly horrifying you start to realize it has been. You know, it's not a very kind wish, but I think it's necessary. I want people to feel outraged and I want people to feel motivated to take action. But I also want people to come away with an understanding on a systems level of what's going on and of the nuances within it, so that in thinking about taking action, they can make sure that they're devising interventions that will actually start to address the issue in a meaningful way,
mm-hmm.
making informed decisions about how to get involved. And then finally, I think on a broader level, there's something about the kind of humanization of people that we tend to dehumanize by lumping them into this category of criminal that I hope comes through in this. And I'm going to make sure it comes through by really privileging the voices and the stories of people so that listeners can begin to connect in a different way.
Well, Nicole, that was really informative.
Yeah, did you learn something?
Of course.
Good. That's what I like to hear.
So what are your next episodes going to be about?
Well, episode 2 is going to situate mass incarceration in the long history of slavery. And it's also going to examine the relationship between mass incarceration and the war on drugs. So we're going to get deep into the history of the recent escalation of the war on drugs, which is actually one of the key driving forces behind the expanding prison populations. Episode 3, we're going to look at the history of urban neighborhoods during the era of mass incarceration and hear from the experiences of individuals and their families who lived in areas in which incarceration rates were highly concentrated. In episode 4, we're going to talk about the lived experience of incarceration. In 5, we're going to talk about the prison industrial complex, which is the whole array of public and private entities that have a stake in maintaining the status quo. And in episode 6, which I'm most excited about, we're going to talk about the emerging movements that are tackling mass incarceration and really doing some exciting and excellent work to start dismantling it, and also thinking about, you know, a better future.
All right. Yeah. I'd like to think about a better future.
Yeah.
So, Nicole, I'm wondering how listeners are able to find out more about mass incarceration in their state.
That is a great question. And fortunately, there's a lot of good information out there, and all you need is an internet connection. So I would point listeners to the Prison Policy Initiative website. They have a lot of excellent information and infographics about mass incarceration nationally. But even better, they have a 50-state interactive map where you can click on your state and find out what is the incarceration rate, what are the racial concentrations, how many people are in prisons versus jails versus under community supervision. So lots of great information there. And you can find that interactive map at www.prisonpolicy.org/profiles. You got that?
I did get that.
Should I repeat it?
Absolutely.
Okay. That is www.prisonpolicy.org/profiles.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I would say if that doesn't work, then just Google Prison Policy Initiative 50 State Map.
Okay.
Something like that.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah, cool.
So who would I need to thank for helping me put this episode together?
Well, really, I put the episode together. But actually, you are one of the people that I need to thank. So the first person I want to thank is Mr. Sean Stewart, Emma Lugo, of course, my lovely and wonderful friend, Ju Young, Trip Banks, local rapper who helped me find the beats, and Clam Slammer 2 and Tuna Beats, who provided the beats that I downloaded for free and used for the podcast.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And then before we go, ask me, where are we, Sean?
Hey, Nicole, where are we at?
I think we're at KBOO. Does that sound right to you?
KBOO Community Radio?
That's right.
Oh, man. They've been broadcasting for almost 50 years with no commercials.
Isn't that amazing?
It's mind-blowing.
Yeah. KBOO.FM, right?
That's right.
Portland.